The Three Martini Lunch is on vacation this week. Jim and Greg will be back with new episodes on Monday, September 11th. The following is a best of the Three Martini Lunch. In this edition, Jim goes off on the Republicans for completely screwing up the Obamacare repeal effort in the United States Senate. We look back at the event that blew up Anthony Scaramucci's brief but very intense time as White House Communications Director. And we examine the number one reason why football fans stopped watching the NFL in 2016.
Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Really bad, really crazy, and good martinis to close out the week, because the bad and the crazy are so awful, we had to end with good because we could not send you into the weekend on either of these other stories. Jim, it was just last week that we had three bads that were really horrible. One was related to health care, and so was our first one today. And then there was the recertification of the Iran nuclear deal. Somehow this one feels even worse. But let's get into it, because if you weren't awake at 1:40-something last night, and if you're sane, you weren't, the skinny repeal lost. That was the last effort before summer recess, it would appear, for Senate Republicans to pass something on health care, get to a conference committee with the House, and possibly pass legislation that would actually do Americans some good. It went down 51-49. That means three Republicans voted against it. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, no big surprises. They didn't even want the debate at all. And then John McCain in his dramatic fashion at the end. And Jim, awful for so many reasons here. Usually it's conservatives that the media and the leadership point fingers at if they opposed legislation that they don't think is conservative enough. But the conservatives got to yes this time. It was the moderates. Collins and Murkowski, of course, as I mentioned, wouldn't even vote to proceed. They voted against every amendment. They voted against skinny repeal, which is about as milquetoast of a Republican plan as you can get, and keeps an entire entitlement program in place. The leadership had 7 years to prepare for this. A lot of it was behind closed doors crafting the legislation. They got surprised when people in their own party didn't like stuff, and ultimately they ended up with a bill that they were promising wouldn't end up being voted on by the House. It would just be a way to set up the conference committee. And then there's John McCain, who was a total prima donna on Thursday night, intentionally holding out to be the final vote and then standing before the Senate with his big dramatic thumbs down so he could be the hero to the mainstream media, which is really his base. And according to Town Hall, McCain refused to tell reporters all day how he would vote, saying only wait for the show. And then in a statement, he explained his vote that he said it failed to guarantee affordable quality health care to Americans. So that's why we need to work with Democrats on this sort of stuff. So a couple of quick clips here as we let you vent as well, obviously. First of all, here's Jim just a few days ago when talking about the McCain cancer diagnosis, about what we hope will actually happen. We hope he beats the disease and we can have more of this.
Hopefully he'll get the most aggressive treatment possible, and we'll still be around to discuss John McCain for good and for ill for a long time.
Yeah, I was laughing too early there. And Jim, you've been very generous with the McCain ads from the 2016 campaign when he was running against Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick, who had voted for Obamacare in the House. Here's the end of one of those ads.
While Kirkpatrick's proud of putting us at risk, John McCain is leading the fight to stop Obamacare.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
He's got an interesting way of showing it, Jim. So how big of a debacle is this?
Really big. Huge, you might say. And it is one of those moments where we spent a good portion of last week defending John McCain. There are many things to admire about this man, but this display was what reminded everyone of why John McCain could really get on their nerves, because the entire supposition of his position on this, like, look, we recognize that it's very tough to get 52 Republicans to agree on a replacement for Obamacare. They didn't want straight repeal. They didn't want the House plan. They have yet to come up with one amongst themselves that will get 52 votes. Skinny repeal was as close as the last ditch option. And the argument was, look, if the Senate passes skinny repeal, the House would not pass that version instantaneously, that it would go to conference, that the negotiators from the Senate, negotiators from the House would really be able to take the Etch-a-Sketch, shake it around, get a blank slate again, and come back with a version that they think could pass both houses. The problem with McCain's position, and if he wants to gripe that this was written in secret, fine. If he wants to gripe that this wasn't done following regular order or enough hearings or enough. I mean, first of all, we've been debating Obamacare for 7 years. So I actually think that everybody involved in this process should know what they're voting for, right? That they should know what they don't like about Obamacare, and they should know about how they want to fix it. If you want to look for a CBO score, fine. But in the heart of it, every version that repeals, say, the individual mandate is going to have a lot of people losing their insurance, in part because they've chosen to not purchase insurance anymore. That's something you and I have discussed in the past. We emphasize is a really disingenuous aspect of this debate. Look, if McCain doesn't like this, fine. But the option before him last night was vote for skinny repeal and keep this process going, very much like with the motion to proceed, or don't vote for it. The entire Jenga tower collapses back down again, and you have to start building back up again. Everyone goes back to square one. He voted for that. That keeps Obamacare in place. So I really don't think you can call yourself as leading the fight to stop Obamacare when you refuse to vote for a bill that will at least in part stop Obamacare. This keeps Obamacare in place. And I'm not going to tear my hair out because I don't want to lose any of it. But this sense that like, oh, but if we go back to the drawing board, we sit down with members of the other party, we can come up with bipartisan common sense reform. What are those? I don't think they exist. I've heard this from people I respect like Peggy Noonan. Everybody says they want to see this. What are those ideas? I don't really think they exist. If you get the lead, both parties sitting down around the table and talking about what they want to do to change Obamacare, to reform it, to fix it, as the Democrats keep insisting, you will learn that they don't actually agree on anything, that they just have fundamentally different ideas about how the healthcare system should work. I've been through this before. Democrats want to enforce the individual mandate more. Republicans want to get rid of it. Democrats want to give the insurance companies additional money to cover the really expensive cases. Most Republicans look at that and say, whoa, 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 now you're subsidizing insurance companies. Now you're bailing them out, just like TARP. The response of Democrats to the problems of Obamacare is a bigger, more expensive Obamacare. And the argument from most Republicans, or at least so we thought, particularly as we're watching the campaign ads from the likes of John McCain, was they wanted to stop it and repeal it and go back to a more of a free market approach. Which would mean, by the way, you'd have to purchase your insurance and you'd have to shop around. It would be actually more, it might be a bigger decision because it would be your responsibility. It would not be the government from on high handing this stuff to you. And oh, by the way, in the process, possibly deciding to decline to give you care because it's now their decision. This really is as bad as it seems. It's not to say that, you know, repeal and replacing Obamacare is impossible. But what McCain seemed to be in denial of, and that everybody, and so was Murkowski and Collins, is that if there was some other idea that could get, you know, a bipartisan majority in the Senate, it would have come up with it by now. Or Democrats would have proposed it by now. There is no magical idea that gets 75 votes in the Senate and that unites both the parties. There really isn't that common ground out there. And it's going to be the same argument in the House. It's not the president was an obstacle to this. I suppose he could have leaned on these three remaining senators more. But in the end, these were three senators who did not want to pass this version and keep the process going. They wanted to go back to square one. This is the Republicans have had, at least in their eyes, control of the House, Senate, and the presidency for the first time since end of 2006. And this is their chance. They've been talking about this since then. Nothing actually changes by the failure to pass this. There is still the exact same challenges of putting together. And deep down, Republicans do not have 52 votes or even 50 votes to repeal and replace Obamacare. There is no Republican plan that can get 50 votes. And that is a shame to them for all the pledges and all the promises they've made over the last 7-8 years. So they have an enormous amount of egg on their faces, an entire grande omelet on their faces today, and they completely deserve it. And McCain and Murkowski and Collins deserve every bit of the grief they're getting this morning.
Jim, that was extraordinarily well said, and I can already see the Republicans trying to spin this, assuming something doesn't get done between now and the midterms, of all these red state Democrats who are up for re-election next year. We were one vote away from moving forward and repealing Obamacare, but Joe Manchin or Heidi Heitkamp or John Tester wouldn't do it. But we didn't need them.
No.
So you can make that argument, and maybe it'll work, that they were intransigent. The Democrats certainly were. They were willing to let your premiums and deductibles go through the roof unless they got whatever it is they want, single payer, massive more government control over the healthcare sector. It's certainly nothing that we're interested in as conservatives, because they've made that clear over time as well. So, the base has every reason to be furious today. But, Jim, fortunately, while it's complete chaos over in the legislative branch that the Republicans control, over at the executive branch that the Republicans also control, things are much... Oh, actually, I'm getting a note now. No, things are completely chaotic in the executive branch as well. It's not just Trump v. Sessions. Anthony Scaramucci, of course, the Wall Street guy who was brought in to be the new communications director a week ago, seems like a couple months ago already, was supposed to tighten up the ship, stop the leaks, keep everybody on message. Well, he is personally doing a horrific job of that. And the most clear crystallization of that is this story from Ryan Lizza at The New Yorker. Quote, on Wednesday night, I received a phone call from Anthony Scaramucci, the new White House communications director. He wasn't happy. Earlier in the night, I'd tweeted, citing a senior White House official, that Scaramucci was having dinner at the White House with President Trump, the First Lady, Sean Hannity, and the former Fox News executive Bill Shine. It was an interesting group and raised some questions. Was Trump getting strategic advice from Hannity? Was he considering hiring Shine? But Scaramucci had his own question for me. Who leaked that to you? He asked. I said I couldn't give him the information. Further on, he responded by threatening to fire the entire White House communications staff. Later he says, is it an assistant to the president? He asked. I again told him I couldn't say. Okay, I'm going to fire every one of them. And then you haven't protected anybody, so the entire place will be fired over the next 2 weeks. This is all on the record, mind you. Then he started talking about Ryan Priebus. Quote, they'll all be fired by me, he said. I fired one guy the other day. I have 3 to 4 people I'll fire tomorrow. I'll get to the person who leaked that to you. Ryan Priebus, if you want to leak something, he'll be asked to resign very shortly. The issue, he said, was that he believed Priebus had been worried about the dinner because he hadn't been invited. Reince is a bleeping paranoid schizophrenic, a paranoiac, Scaramucci said. He channeled Priebus, apparently imitating his voice, I guess, as he spoke. Oh, Bill Shine is coming in. Let me leak the bleeping thing and see if I can bleep these people the way I bleeped Scaramucci for 6 months. Priebus did not respond to a request for comment. Later on, Scaramucci also told me that unlike other senior officials, he had no interest in media attention. I'm not Steve Bannon. I'm not trying to... do something that's anatomically impossible. Quote, I'm not trying to build my own brand off the bleeping strength of the president. I'm here to serve the country. Jim, what is going on?
You know, but let's begin, Greg, with the idea that somebody who gets the position White House communications director really should know that unless you say this is off the record, right, a reporter will not treat your comments as off the record. Scaramucci's first response on Twitter was to say, I trusted a reporter. I won't make that mistake again. Well, I just kind of figure you'd know that, right? If you're going to suggest that Steve Bannon can do something that is really anatomically difficult, you probably want to keep that off the record, unless you want Steve Bannon to be, you know, aiming for you, as well as Reince Priebus, as well as the entire White House communications staff. It reminded me, Greg, very much of he was trying to do Tony Montana in Scarface, particularly the part where he says he wants to kill all the leakers. I kept waiting for say hello to my little friend. You know, this furious billowing rage and you know, one guy after another. And he's you know, and Reince does, you know, he's called the FBI on Reince. And, you know, like on the record, you're telling a reporter you've called the FBI and the Department of Justice to investigate the president's chief of staff for illegally leaking. Let's also keep in mind, by the way, leaks, unless you're leaking classified information, a leak is not illegal. It can be unethical. It can be bad. It can be detrimental to the president's agenda. It can be detrimental to all that stuff. Let's keep in mind that what set off Scaramucci is the fact that Ryan Lizza had reported he was seen in a restaurant eating with Sean Hannity. That was the leak. That was what set this off. This was the state's, and he honest to goodness says to him, you know, I'm asking you as an American to tell me who, like as if this is like the nuclear codes or something like that. his entire sense of perspective is baffling. But the other thing is, I was discussing this with some very smart, well-connected conservative bloggers, people who are in much better terms with the White House than I am. They said, look, this is Scaramucci putting on a performance for an audience of one, right? That Scaramucci, this is to please and entertain and to impress his new boss, President Trump. President Trump is going to read all these F-bombs, and he's going to find this article to be hilarious. He's going to love Scaramucci's attitude. Donald Trump is, you know, going to say, yeah, you give him hell, Mooch. and he'll be completely happy with this. But the problem with doing this performance for an audience of one is that you're doing it on a stage where everybody else can see it. Right? It's one thing to suck up to the boss behind closed doors. It's another thing to suck up to the boss and trash all of your coworkers and come across as like kind of an unhinged maniac on the record to a reporter, and to do it in a way that everybody else that everybody else can see. Because now Scaramucci, like if you're a, you know, we talked in the previous Martini about the difficulty of the healthcare vote. Look, if you're a, considering that in the past week Trump has, you know, trashed Jeff Sessions, and he's brought in this nut job to be his chief communicator. If you're a Republican senator, just how far do you want to stick your neck out for the president of the United States? Right? I mean, Scaramucci is, you know, I suppose we should give him a little bit of credit. He said he wasn't going to stab anybody in the back. And when on the record you're denouncing Bannon and Priebus, I suppose we should give him credit for stabbing them in the front. I just have this crazy idea, Greg, that the White House might work better if everybody was rowing in the same direction and they spend a little less time trying to knife each other and a little more focus on actually getting the president's agenda enacted into law and actually communicating what his administration is doing and all this kind of stuff. There's this constant Game of Thrones palace intrigue that it's not just that like you can say, oh, the media covers this too much. And look, yeah, maybe you can make that argument, but it certainly seems like everybody in the White House is perfectly comfortable to play to this. Everybody in the White House seems to really relish this. And I think to a certain extent, the president relishes this, except it's not the people's business. That's not what we sent them there to do. So it's there's absolutely no reason to think that, you know, there were some people saying, look, Scaramucci should be fired 1 week into the job. I don't think President Trump is going to do that. As my colleague Ramesh Panuru pointed out, also, look, this is still an administration that has a ton of empty spots that they still need to fill. Would you want to work in this White House?
Not with that
guy. Would you
want
to work next to Scaramucci? Would you, let you know, knowing that, you know, he's probably screaming to Ryan Lizza on the phone about all the different things he's going to do to you? I have a hard time believing that. He also at one point offered this really creative idea. In order to punish the leaker, he would fire the entire White House communication staff.
Right.
That'll show him. I have no staff anymore, but that I know I got the leaker somewhere in there amongst all those other people I fired.
It's just baffling to me, Jim, how a guy who is a, you know, a filthy rich, arrogant, vulgar liberal who claims to have all the solutions but really has quite few would appeal to Donald Trump.
Somebody said, yeah, look, you know, Trump looks in the mirror and he sees Mooch looking back at him.
Oh, we have to have good news to end the week. There's just too much badness. So let's move on to sports, which has usually been the source of crazy or bad martinis in recent months. But this one actually helps us believe that there's still some sense in the minds of sports fans. Courtesy of ESPN, no less, national anthem protests were the top reason that NFL fans watched fewer games last season, according to a new survey released by J.D. Power. The pollster said it asked more than 9,200 people who either attended one football, basketball, or hockey game whether they tuned into fewer games and why. 26% of those who did watch fewer games last season said that national anthem protests, some of which were led by Colin Kaepernick, were the reason. After that, 24% of those surveyed who said they watched fewer games said that they did so because of the league's off-the-field image issues with domestic violence or with game delays, including penalties. 1 in 5 listed excessive commercials and advertising. 16% said it was because of their interest being replaced by the 2016 campaign, and 5% said they watched fewer games because they got rid of cable. So, Jim, it's kind of a mixed bag about why the people stopped watching, but it's clear that dragging politics into sports was a major reason.
Yeah, I was going to say, I looked at this and I felt, besides a little bit of vindicated, I also think it's worth noting, by the way, the reaction, the idea of players who were involved in domestic violence and other criminal activity. I think we can look back to that of the Ray Rice case, and I don't think there are too many people who would say that the National Football League handled that particularly well. The initial suspension was very small, and it really seemed like the National Football League Commissioner Goodell and everybody else were kind of not eager to dwell on this, that they wanted to give them kind of the league equivalent of a slap on the wrist and move on. I understand that Ray Rice's fiance and you know was urging the league to be lenient to him, but that still doesn't necessarily make a decision that most people were comfortable with. We've seen professional athletes getting in trouble for a very long time. But you kind of wonder if at some point there's a tipping point. There's a kind of a moral event horizon that gets crossed where people cannot in good conscience continue to root for this guy. And it's worth noting that was only about a percentage point behind. But the single biggest reason people were watching fewer football games was the national anthem protest. And so if you're watching sports media like I do when you need an escape from the realm of politics, you still hear quite a bit on ESPN and other sports talk radio stations. A lot of discussion of Colin Kaepernick is getting unfairly treated. He's being blackballed. He's being punished for taking his political stand. That this is the league basically kind of conspiring to keep him out of the game, et cetera. Look, when you see numbers like this, first of all, I think Colin Kaepernick is actually on the downside of his career. You look at some of those games he played last year. He actually is not starting caliber anymore. He's getting sloppier as a player, less consistent, and most teams would like to try somebody new who's got more of an upside in the years to come. Having said that, if the guy brings a great deal of controversy along with him, maybe a team, this makes it even more potentially problematic. People argue about whether or not he would be a distraction. Most locker rooms can tune out a great deal of media coverage and controversy and things like that. I'm sure a lot of NFL team owners and probably general managers look at Kaepernick and think he's just not worth the trouble. There's not enough upside on the field to deal with the potential response from fans. And I realize there are a lot of people in sports commentary and probably quite a few professional athletes who do not like the fact that the fan base for the NFL is largely older, whiter, and more conservative and gets really, really offended when you don't stand for the national anthem. But you know what, guys? This is your customer base. If you want to play to progressives, fine, but that's not going to happen overnight. And oh, by the way, my sneaking suspicion is there are a bunch of progressives who are into football, but there are a lot of progressives who aren't into football. And maybe you just want to stick with the really big football fan base that you have. There's that great line in the Concussion movie where the cynical doctor says, they took a day of the week and claimed it for itself, and it used to belong to God. Right? I mean, football was this enormously powerful and still is the most popular sport in the country. And it's this giant cultural force. The one thing that really brings all Americans together is the Super Bowl. It turned into a national holiday of sorts, right? It's And what did Colin Kaepernick do? He figured out how to get football fans to stop watching football games on television. Like, that's almost like an inverse miracle, right? I mean, that takes real talent, you could say. That's a really unbelievable skill. He did something that Terrell Owens could never do, right? Take any controversial figure in NFL history, and none of them could turn people away from watching football the way Colin Kaepernick did. And they're surprised that no team is lining up to sign him for his skills? I don't think we should be surprised at all. I think those of us who said, look, this was bringing politics and very divisive social controversies into a realm where it had been kind of an escape from the world's problems, I think those of us who thought this was a bad idea and that Kaepernick really was playing with fire by taking this stance, that the form of taking this protest was particularly alienating and probably going to be counterproductive, I think it's great, very clearly vindication for this perspective. So I feel bad for Colin Kaepernick. I understand he made an announcement. He did not plan on kneeling for the national anthem for the remainder of this season or the coming season. He felt like he had done what he needed to do. Oh, by the way, he's a free agent and he's looking for a new team. Right. So maybe he recognized the controversy was making it tougher for him to get signed. But look, when you are the one figure who can get a football fan to turn off a television screen, no wonder teams don't want to sign him. And I think it's a great teachable moment for everybody in professional sports.
Wow. Jim, vintage Garrity today. Unfortunately, not a lot of the stories were great, but fantastic job today. We'll reconvene on Monday, and we have an entire weekend to cleanse the palate, and boy, do we need it.
All right. Looking forward to that, Greg. See you Monday.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great weekend, everyone, and be sure to tune in on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.